Podcasting from Portland East to Portland West, from Big Pine Key to Pacific Beach, and from San Juan to Guam, this is All Across America.
Well, we're here today with Patty Hamilton, Patricia Hamilton. Patty has been in the art world for coming on 50 years now at the Whitney Museum in New York. She had a position with Art in America magazine, worked for Andrew Crispo as a curator at the Crispo Gallery. And then at the age of 25, started her own gallery, the Hamilton Gallery. She was a founding member of Art Table, artist rep, and most recently the author of The Blonde with the Balls. So Patty, welcome to All Across America.
Well, welcome.
Well, as I said, you know, let's start it out with a bang, and you know, we'll get into the whole art world and your what you like about art and the business side, and but I wanted to start off with the naming of the book. So how did you become known as
I actually didn't come up with the blonde with the balls name. Joseph E. Levine came up with the blonde with the balls name.
Right.
I was the curator of the infamous, and I say infamous, Andrew Crispo.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, he died like 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Right.
And I was quoted in the obituary. He was the crookedest, most notorious dealer I ever worked for. And
he went
to jail twice. And he was a complete crook.
Yeah.
And I was afraid, even though everything was documented in magazines and newspapers, I was afraid he was going to sue me. And so I was happy. He died a crystal meth addict at 78 and was about to get kicked out of his apartment, and he had teeth loose, and I mean, he died very much alone at the age of 78. So when I started out, I was, I don't know, 23, and I worked for Andrew Crispo doing this show called 10 American Masters of Watercolor. Avery Birchfield, DeMuth, Dove, Homer, Hopper, Marin, Prendergast, Sargent, and Wyeth. And I went to have lunch with Nicky Wyeth, who was the son of Andrew Wyeth, and he could only give me 2 watercolors for sale. And he recommended I get in touch with Joseph E. Levine. And Joseph E. Levine had produced any number of movies, the least of which was Cleopatra. With Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. And I expected, in my mind, a Charlton Heston type. I mean, I expected a hunk. And I walked into his office on 7th Avenue, and it was a short, pear-shaped Jewish guy with pockmarks all over his face, smoking a cigar. And no sooner had I gotten the words out of my mouth saying we were doing a very prestigious show and we wanted to borrow a number of his Andrew Wyeth, he said, why should I lend my Wyeth watercolors to a punk kid like you? He was so insulting that I couldn't believe it. And I put up with about 20 minutes of it. And I zipped up my attaché case and I said, well, clearly you won't lend. And I went up out the door and I stopped and I said, by the way, I said, I'm going to go out and borrow the shittiest, most weak Andrew Wyeth watercolors, hang them next to John Singer Sargent's from the Metropolitan Museums, DeMuth's from the Whitney Museum, Prendergast from the Columbus Museum. I am going to go and borrow the shittiest Andrew Wyeth watercolors known to man, that people will wonder why they are even in the show. And I said, and what, pray tell, do you think will happen to the value of your Andrew Wyeth watercolors? Kerblumy. And I said, it was a pleasure to meet you. And I walked out the door and I burst into tears. So I took the cab on 7th Avenue and I went back into the gallery, and Andrew was falling off his couch. He was laughing so hard. And Joseph E. Levine called him minutes after I left and said, who's the blonde with the balls? So with a name like that, you know, you couldn't not help but call the book The Blonde with the Balls. So he lent all of his 6 watercolors, and the New York Times came out with a big article about the show, and they said, just to see the Joseph E. Levine, Andrew Wyeth watercolors, it's worth seeing, paying admission. And, you know, it raved about the show. And Andrew Wyeth, who I later in life sold some watercolors to buy this house, actually. And Andrew Wyeth told me, and he said, now, let me guess. You were going to ruin my watercolor reputation with a group show on 57th Street? And I said, well, I was really, really pissed. And he said, I don't think it would have ruined my reputation. He said, Joseph E. Levine went bankrupt at the end of his life. And he said, and I bought the watercolors back from him at half the price. And I thought, perfect. Just perfect. So that's the way I start the book. I was a ballsy woman. I mean, when I got the lease on 57th Street, I told the landlord that I was a direct descendant of Alexander Hamilton, who was the first Secretary of Treasury of this country. And now, if you've seen Hamilton, you know he was broke. But then in 1974, you didn't know he was broke. And, you know, I told him I was from a wealthy family. And wouldn't have trouble paying the rent. And in fact, I, you know, had trouble paying the rent. So, you know, I was the blonde with the balls.
All right. And you've had, as we talked about, a lot of different roles that maybe you could talk about, you know, for folks that may not know the art world so much, the difference between, you know, a gallery director, a curator, you've got, you know, dealers, of course, artists in the mix, artists representative, buyers representative. Can you kind of walk us through the different roles?
Well, galleries generally, are there to sell art. Andrew Crispo, for instance, would take things on consignment, which meant no money changed hands. And, you know, you would have a hell of a time getting works back from consignment. Larry Gagosian, for instance, tells people that they're worth a certain amount, you know, $2 million. And then he calls back and says, well, we have an offer for 1.5, and I want my commission. And, you know, they whittle away at the price. I don't think it's completely honest, but, you know, that's what they do. So they artists represent people and represent artists, and they work on a 50-50 basis, or in sculpture, you take the cost of the material off And you know, Frank Stella has a show now at Casman. He made these huge sculptures, and he's got a show at Casman, and he's got these huge sculptures, and he'll take the cost off the top and then split 50-50. So it takes about a third of the cost to represent sculpture. And films, it would be the cost off the top.
Okay. But your canvas, canvas is a straight 50-50.
Canvas is a straight 50-50, but if you have a famous artist, it's 60-40 for the artist. Okay. Or if it's a really famous artist, like Jasper Johns, you have a 90-10.
90-10, all right. Yeah. That's
on the other hand, you know, to get a Jasper Johns that sells for $2 or $3 million and there's a waiting list for his work, you know, it's a pleasure.
Fair enough. Oh, and so the gallery is getting that 50%, or the artist representative is getting that 50%?
The artists are getting 50% and the galleries are getting 50%. And now, the artist representative generally gets a piece from the artist, or in my case, I was paid by the artist.
Okay. So if an artwork sells for $1 million, the gallery gets 500,000, the artist gets 500,000. And if you're the artist rep, you're getting a percentage of that artist's 500,000.
Well, I generally get $1,500 a month.
So. Oh, wow. Okay. So that's on a retainer.
It was a retainer.
Wow. Okay. All right. And then what is, you hear the term art dealer. What really does that mean?
An art dealer is somebody that has a gallery either in New York or LA, or a private dealer, deals with, represents artists or clients, and they try and get the best deal for their clients.
All right. Well, maybe you could walk us through. I mean, you've had all these roles. You started at the Whitney Museum in New York. Let's hear a little bit about that, and you know, your position with Art in America.
I started at the Whitney Museum. I was 22. I was working for the chief curator. You know, I was his gopher, you know, I mean, I was the chief curator's gopher. I mean, you know, I would type letters and I would file them away or deal with artists or come up with a map of him to go around around Soho to pick artists for the Whitney Biennial and arrange plane fares and sort of things, you know. And the first call I got, was Alexander Calder, was the first show I represented. And I hadn't been at the gallery more than 3 days. And that guy walked in and he was completely plotzed. I mean, you know, completely shit-faced. And it was 10:30 or 11 o'clock in the morning. And I thought, oh, this is familiar. And I wondered if that was the way all artists were. Well, most artists are drug addicts or alcoholics.
Okay. So. And let me ask you this, because, you know, in reading the book, you know, you said that your father was an alcoholic, your sister was an alcoholic as well, you know, really almost died from her alcoholism in a way. And many of the characters, many of the people that you came across in your work and in your book were alcoholics as well. I mean,
right.
Were you in a way, in a perverse way, maybe drawn to that sort of personality, given your upbringing?
Of course. I mean, you know, of course. Yeah. I was raised in an alcoholic family. I'm what is known as an Al-Anon, which is I want to fix them and I want to make them better. And yeah, of course. But you know, if in the art world, it's a lot of people. Hard it's a lot it. Of people.
Yeah.
You know, drinking 24/7 is not unusual in the art.
And you said the drugs as well, which leads us to Andrew Crispo. And when we were talking, I guess it was a couple of weeks ago in the backyards in Whitley Heights, and you were in the New York Times that morning.
From the Andrew Crispo
obituary. Yeah. So, I mean, maybe you could kind of walk us through the story of...
Well, Andrew Crispo was the crookedest dealer I've ever worked for. You know... Things would come on consignment and, you know, he'd rip the labels off the back and he wouldn't pay bills. And, you know, people would come after me for bills. And, you know, I left because he wouldn't pay, you know, shipping and insurance to museums. It was unbelievable. And he had also had a staff of... You know, incompetence. I mean, this guy, Ronnie Caron, couldn't read or write. And he was supposed to be selling art. I mean, I wouldn't trust that guy as far as I could throw him. And but he had one client, Baron Thiessen. And Baron Thiessen had a first-rate collection in Europe. The Thiessen Museum in Lugano, Switzerland. And he bought Andrew had an eye for early American art. And he had a great eye, but, I just couldn't work for him anymore because he was so dishonest. So when I left, he would call people up on the phone and tempt them with cocaine and partying up to his loft. And, you know, there was a guy named Igel Vesti, who was a Swedish model, who came up to his loft. And Igel Vesti went up to his assistant, Lagaris's private home, and they shot him.
And this was up in Rockland County in upstate New
York. Yeah, Rockland County. And they shot him, and they put the shotgun in the air conditioning vent of the Andrew Crispo Gallery, which is unbelievable to me. And there were drugs involved, obviously.
Yeah.
And Bernard Lagaris tried to get Andrew Crispo to testify, and he wouldn't, but they got him for tax evasion. They finally did. Got
the,
him for
the
tax
Al Capone
evasion.
Method.
Right, at the Al Capone method. And he did like 4 to 5 years for tax evasion. And then he tried to kidnap a judge's granddaughter because his house had blown up and Long Island Lighting had run a gas line under it and lit the fire. And he wasn't getting the money fast enough. And he tried to kidnap a judge's granddaughter. And he got caught. And he got, you know, I think he did 11 years in prison.
Total.
And no, pretty much no one would deal with him after that.
Yeah.
I mean, he was on the cover of New York Magazine and, you know, he was everywhere.
Yeah. It's, your quote in the New York Times is saying your time working for him was a horror show. And, you know, a lot of people, I mean, it really literally was a horror show, a harder shows. And just to get back to your story of the death of Igel Vesti, 3 weeks after the incident, I'm just reading from the obituary in the New York Times, and I'll read the headline. I mean, it's the most damning obituary probably I've ever read. It says, Andrew Crispo, disgraced Manhattan gal gallery owner, dies at 78. His fall from the pinnacle of the New York art world involved murder, torture, tax evasion, extortion, and 2 terms in prison. And in talking about the death of Mr. Vesti, it said 3 weeks later, a group of hikers found Vesti's body in an abandoned smokehouse near the home. Mr. Vesti was naked, save for handcuffs around his wrists and a zippered leather hood over his head. Forest animals had eaten away most of his flesh, save that for around his head, which had been protected by the mask. And this was known as the death mask.
The mask was a Nancy Grossman mask. It was an artwork he owned, and he put it on the face of Igel Vesti.
And he did no time for this
incident. No.
So, I mean, he was like essentially, allegedly, I'll say, I guess he's dead. So we're past worrying about that. But he was like the OJ of the art world.
He was pretty bad, but until the Knoedler scandal came out, he was the most notorious, person in the art world.
All right. Well, let's hear about the Knoedler scandal.
Well, the Knoedler scandal, things were slow. I'm trying to think of what year it was. And the doorman met a woman at a Soho art party who said she had blue chip art. And he took her into Ann Friedman. And Ann Friedman didn't do the 5 things I suggest you do, which was a crystal clear provenance. I mean, you trace it from the artist's studio to the collector. I mean, you have a bill of sale from a collector. I mean, you have to be very, very careful about provenances. And also, a lot of things are repainted and touched up. And you have to have a conservator go over it to say whether it's been repainted or touched up. And Ann Friedman was desperate for business. And she sold 65 fakes from Glaphyria Rosales.
Wow.
And they finally had a show of all of the Motherwell Spanish elegies. And a company came in New York, and they looked at the paintings and they decided they were fake. And fake was stamped on the back of all of them. And this one client that had bought a Rothko read this in the newspaper and said, "Oh my God, what about our Rothko?" And he was CEO of Gucci at that point. And he tried everything in the world to get Knoedler to take it back. And Knoedler wouldn't take it back. And so he sued them. And at that point, Knoedler had closed. At one point, when the Motherwells had been deemed fake, the president of Knoedler had fired Ann Friedman. And I mean, she bought a Jackson Pollock from Glaphyria Rosales with Pollock spelled wrong. I mean, it's unbelievable. At any rate, she is skating on. I mean, when she goes into the art fairs, people go away.
The sea parts.
Sea part. And she sold 65 fakes, and what can I say? Knoedler had to pay a lot of money. So
yeah.
And, so we were closed.
Yeah.
I mean, the oldest gallery in New York closed.
150 years old.
150 years old.
So you were talking about your five rules for buying a very expensive work of art. To walk us through those.
First of all, is the provenance. You got to have a clear provenance. Secondly, it is the IFAR, which is IFAR is the name of the organization that went to judge the Motherwells incorrectly. And they have a scientific community that judges paint, whether it was even invented at the time.
Right. Carbon dating, paint. Right.
Yeah, right. So the provenance and IFAR and, ArtNet. ArtNet came out in 1990, and it lists all of the similar paintings to yours that you can. So before you go to a gallery, you should go on ArtNet and find something that's sold at auction that is similar to yours. Mm-hmm. And that was the three. And the fourth is to go to a reputable dealer. I mean, mm-hmm. there you can think of any number of dealers that are reputable, and you can go to them. And the fifth,
certificate of authentication.
Oh, the certificate.
Can you tell us about that?
The certificate of authenticity. Every art dealer, every artist that's dead has a certificate of authenticity. And for instance, Pollock will no longer justify any Pollocks being made, you know, comes to the Pollocks, they will
everything
not.
Everything that's out there has already been discovered or.
Right. And they did a lot of research, and they did many, many years. And so you have to have a certificate of authenticity from the owner, from the authority on the field.
Wow. Okay. And is that authority the estate of a deceased artist, or governing body of some sort?
An art historian.
An art historian. Okay.
Yeah.
And tell us, walk us back, if we could, to the opening of the Hamilton Gallery and how that happened. I mean, I'm just amazed you're 25 years old and, you know, you had an opening with 700. I mean, just raising the money alone and not coming from a wealthy background where, you know, it was
about 70% of the women were women. And they were like Jewish women, and they saw me as their daughter. And and 30% were WASPs, you know. But you know that is generally the case. I had about 15 backers, and mm-hmm. I had two openings. One was the general opening, which was the 700 people, and somebody put a mink coat on a sculpture. I couldn't believe it. I said, and I picked the mink coat up and I took it into my closet. And then the black tie opening was dinner at 21 and a black tie opening. So that was pretty cool. And there were seven artists to begin with. And of course, I started off the exhibition with a group show. And then, you know, most of them weren't in the art world and they didn't realize how hard it was to get a review. And that the group show got a review in the New York Times was unbelievable.
Right.
And I started selling right away. But then I had Clem Meadmore, who really wanted to run the gallery. I mean, he had run the gallery in Australia, and he had basically run the gallery in New York. And he really thought that this young kid, he could push around. And he said to me, like, the night before his opening, that he didn't want to be with the gallery anymore. And I said, bye-bye. We'll have the show, and then you're out of there.
Right.
So, but he didn't. And then Deborah Remington, who was a notorious bitch. I mean, just horrible. Those were the two I started out with. But after that, it got easier.
You represented a lot of mid-career artists?
Mid-career and mostly women. Wow. 60% women. I mean, if you want to represent artists that have been ignored, in 1978, it was women. Yeah. I showed Louise Bourgeois, who is like the most famous 20th century sculptor. And she sells for, you know, millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And I showed Louise Bourgeois in 1978. And she was the one that wanted to have her performance in the gallery.
Tell us about that.
Oh, God. She came up with an idea of boxes. They were 66 boxes, and they were small to large, and around an oval shape of the gallery. And in the middle were latex body parts of males, and mostly males, and on a table. And people compared it to Hieronymus Bosch, the dinner, you know, to some of his works. And she took me to, well, she, I took her to lunch in Chelsea, which was not anything at that point. Mm-hmm. And I took her to the Empire Diner in Chelsea. And she said, I have a fantastic idea. And I said, okay. And I'm, I don't know, 27, 28 at this point. And she said, I would like to have a performance. And I said, excuse me? And she said, I want to have 66 black angry dwarfs willing to perform in the nude.
Okay.
And I said, where in the fuck would I get them? And she said, Small People, Inc. I mean, she, you know, and I said, there's no way I'm not having 66 angry dwarves perform in the nude. It's just, there's no way. So we settled on 66 art world types. And they would stand in boxes, and people were fighting to get into the boxes. You know, collectors and curators and writers, and you know, it was very prestigious. So it was, and that piece is in the Guggenheim Museum right
really?
Now. Oh yeah. Wow. Oh yeah.
Wow. And so you talked about representing women artists, and I know you're a founding member of Art Table. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Well, Art Table was gotten because Lila Harnett, who worked for Q Magazine and wrote under the name of a male, she said there's no place for art dealers to go and women in the art world to go to complain about the men. And so I went to a dinner, and the dinner was a number of PR people from Sotheby's Park Burnett, mm-hmm. and the journalist from the Wall Street Journal, and Lila Harnett, and we came up with the name Art Table, and it turned out to be 12 of us. And it's now 1,200 people. All across the country.
Wow.
All across the country.
Wow. Okay.
And it's 30 years old.
30 years and old.
It's 30 years old.
And you were one of the OGs.
Yeah.
So we talked a little bit about having group shows, and from what you said, you represented all these artists, but only two or three of them, their works sold well, and all the other artists were supported by those sales. Can you talk a little bit about that dynamic, and is that hold true for most galleries today?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you have your best sellers, and they carry you through, through the rest of them. But now, if the work doesn't sell, you're gone. I mean, I carried, any number of artists because they were good artists and because I was devoted to the work.
Right.
But Joan Snyder and Isaac Witkin both basically were the sellers. And I mean, Isaac Witkin made small bronzes and they sold like hotcakes. And Joan Snyder, everything, but she only made 9 paintings a year, and everything everything was for sale. And but today, it was a family business then.
Yeah.
I mean, it was you were married to your artists. I mean, you were talking to them, and you were visiting them at their country house, and they were coming to dinner. And now it's strictly business.
Really?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's very different. It's very different. And, and the art market is very soft right now. So, these art fairs, while they're doing well this year, I don't think they'll be doing well in the following year,
Why do you think the art world is soft right now? The
market? Because it was overindulged, and there were too many galleries and too many artists.
And now there's these galleries. I mean, they got Ghost Scene Gallery. It's got, 8 different locations.
Oh, no. 15 to 20 different 15 locations.
15 to 20. Oh, wow.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
I talk about it in my book. Gagosian has 15 to 20. Hauser & Wirth has, 11 to 12. I mean, if you don't have a gallery in New York, LA, and maybe in Hong Kong or Seoul, you just aren't taken seriously.
Oh, okay. And maybe we could get back to some of your favorite works. And you talked about Snyder, and what has distinguished them in your mind, and what made people so attracted to them?
John Snyder was a great painter. I mean, I sold I showed a 6 foot by 40 foot painting about rape, and it's now in the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. And then she had a child, and everything was groovy, and she made beautiful works. In the 70s, she made stroke paintings, lines of different colors. And then she made landscapes. And she's just gone with Thaddeus Ropeck in Europe and Canada in New York. And the paintings sell for hundreds of thousands at auction, and I showed her for the whole time I was open.
Wow. And so what would you say? You talked about sculpture, I mean, canvas. What's your favorite medium? I mean, has your taste evolved over the years? What do you have on your walls?
I did a show about a year ago, or maybe 2 years ago, called Kick Ass Painting, which was abstract painting from New York. And they were Brenda Goodman and Louise Fishman and Carrie Moyer. And it was a beautiful show.
Nice.
And did really well. Great. So, but everything is all on the internet now, and it's very different now.
Yeah.
We used to have transparencies. We sent the clients and we hoped they'd buy, but now it's all on Instagram and Facebook and
JPEGs and all.
Yeah, JPEGs. Yeah.
So what brought you, I mean, you're in the Hollywood Hills now. What brought you from, you know, all the way from 57th Street, where you had your gallery in New York, to L.A.? And now you're out in your country.
I wanted to get out of New York, and I heard of this gallery opening, a gallery in Beverly Hills, and it was called Salander O'Reilly, also a sleazebag. And I got the directorship of the gallery and moved out here.
Wow. All right. And you've been out in L.A. ever since.
Yeah, I've been out since 1990.
And so you said New York, L.A. and Hong Kong are the two or three Seoul. Biggest markets.
Seoul.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
How did that come to be?
Well, there's a whole chapter on it in my book. There's certainly no tax in Seoul.
Okay.
Yeah, that for starters. And people buy like crazy in Seoul. Okay. And many galleries are opening branches in Seoul.
Really?
Yeah.
And you talked about art as being too much of a commodity these days. I mean, do you see that changing? Do you see that becoming even more of a thing? I mean, there are people that don't...
Well, I mean, you know, people buy art like, you know, I got a call the other day from an art dealer I respected who also closed her gallery. And she spoke to David McKee, who was one of the great dealers of my day, and represented among others Philip Guston, and he said to her, "Remember how we used to represent artists?" And she said, "Yes, of course." And she said, "Now I represent collectors." I mean, collectors have an idea. They want this to fill out their portfolio, and they put it in warehouses.
Right.
And they flip it at auction.
Yeah.
And in 3 years, they don't even live with it.
They may not even see the painting in person.
No, they don't see the painting.
That's crazy.
Well, you know, it's what it is right now.
So let me ask you this. What do you have hanging on your walls? I mean, in terms of sculpture, canvas, like what do you have at your home?
I have 40 works of art hanging in the house and 40 works of art and wrapped in the garage, you know? I mean, you know, I have paintings that I love and, you know, but I'm an old-fashioned dealer.
Right. Okay. And, you know, I was reading in the acknowledgement section of your book, you always find the good stuff in the appendix, the acknowledgements.
Uh-huh.
And so very rarely, I mean, I don't often read the acknowledgements, but you thanked somebody that most people don't. And you thanked your lawyer. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, you've had my lawyer. Oh, my God. My lawyer was... he represented me when Deborah Remington initiated a lawsuit against a couple of my backers, and he got it thrown out of court because they were limited partners and they were trying to tell me what to do.
Right.
And he got it thrown out of court, and he collected, and I stayed friendly with him. And then I went to write the book, and I said, I'm writing a book and blah, 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 blah. And he read the book and, you know, he said, you can't say this. You can't say this. You know, you'll get sued for this. And then he's trying to get a movie deal for me. I mean, he's a friend.
Yeah.
He's a friend.
Did you feel that being a young woman in the art world that was so dominated by men that you needed to have that extra firepower at your back?
And absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the great story is there was a show at my gallery called Sculpture and the Constructivist Tradition. And Robert Murray, who was a dealer, was bringing a painting, a sculpture that had to be hoisted up the front of my building through the window in my office that they would take out and into the gallery. And the guy was 2 hours late, and the guy had been paying his assistant the entire time. And the guy walks in and said, "Hey, big tits, where do you want the sculpture?" And I looked at him like this is out of Ripley's Believe It or Not. And I said, "Excuse me?" And he said, he repeated it.
Wow.
And I said, "Eddie, your name is." He said, "Eddie." And I said, "I'm going to call your boss." So I called the boss, and the boss said, "Oh, that's Eddie." And I said, "Well, I'd like you to give you the name of his union. And I want a black mark put on the name of his union." And I said, "Does he go into Leo Castelli and say, 'Hey, Mr. Little Dick, where do you want the sculpture?'" I said, "Does he go into Andre Emmerich and say, 'Mr. Impotent, where do you want the sculpture?'" And I said, this was so insulting. And I said, if you don't give me the name of his union and the name of his representative, I said, I'm going to file suit against you and have my lawyer call you and get you the name of his union. So he gave me the name. And years later, I was hoisting out a sculpture out of the sixth floor down the front of the building. And he said, Eddie said to the artist, "Who's your dealer?" And he said, "Pat Hamilton." And he said, "Bitch." So I guess
you had an effect on him.
I was effective.
Well, we were one of the funniest quotes in the book was an artist by the name of Glenn Goldberg. And he was, you know, up and coming. And, you know, he said out loud, "Many people are comparing me to Jasper Johns." And your quote to him were, "These are the kind of things you whisper to your wife late at night, not the kind of things you say out loud."
So, to his agent, you know, of all people, to his agent. You know, I mean, he had an ego that was the size of Manhattan at that point. And it was ridiculous.
So what's your advice to young artists or people, younger folks in the art world, up-and-coming folks? I mean, obviously, this is one of them, but what else would you recommend?
Well, you know, you can get a gallery and you can sell really well, but don't count on it. I mean, don't count on your every series selling well. I mean, people are famous for 5 minutes, as Andrew Warhol said, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you just have to take care of, you know, you have to take care of it. You know, you have to take care and keep your ego intact.
I mean, that's probably good advice for any industry, I would say, right? I mean,
well, you know, Kanye West, you know, would be a typical example.
I mean, he's on another level, I think. But you've talked about the three things that made you so successful were networking, reputation, and integrity.
Well, networking, you know, you have to go out and shake hands, and integrity, you have to have a crystal clean integrity. I mean, you know, which is why I left Crispo, because I thought his bad reputation would be indicative of, you know, rub off on me.
Yeah.
And, networking, integrity, and what was the other thing?
Reputation.
Well, you know, you got to have a clean reputation.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You have to have a very clean, because people in the art world talk.
Everybody talks.
Well, people in the art world really talk.
Yeah, I bet. And we were talking before we started the show. You were just at a networking event in LA, and I mean, tell us what you're up to now and what's next.
Well, you know, I'm trying to get speaking engagements, and trying to get into bookstores, and you know, I think I've got New York handled and LA handled, but I've got, and I'm reaching out to art table buddies in Santa Fe and Boston and other places.
Great. Well, how can folks pick up the book, find out more about you?
Well, Amazon.
Right.
Amazon, and you can get in touch with me.
Excellent. All right. Well, Patty, thanks very much for being on the show, and it's been a pleasure, and folks, go out and pick up the book, The Blonde with the Balls.
Yeah, well, it's also colon, the
an insider's view of the art world, and that's it. And it's 100%.
Insider's view of the art world, which most people don't talk about.
No, and it's definitely, as you said, having to go through with a lawyer, it's definitely no holds barred, you know, view of the world. And it's definitely a slice of life, a slice of that world, like unlike anything else I'd imagine. So pick it up.
Well, it's unique.
All right.
Well.